Hello and good morning, Rob. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Errol. How are you doing?
Absolutely fantastic. I'm going to start things off with an oddball question. I want to know why people like yourself are not called doctors of taste, because you know so much about food, about how food is digested as well as seen. I mean, there's so much that you know that I think it deserves to be a doctor.
I think you can call me a doctor of taste today, Errol. I'm fine with that. It's better than being a doctor of distaste, right? Oh, like, I don't want to be a doctor of distaste.
Isn't that the truth? How did you get involved? Because I was that kid in Billings, Montana in the 1960s and 70s that was always in my mother's kitchen trying to reinvent fried bologna. How did you get your first steps into it all?
It's a good question. So I think maybe there are two pieces. One is that I was that kid that was outside catching snakes, catching turtles, looking at frogs, but also in the kitchen and thinking about food. And it wasn't until many years later that those two things started to connect. My wife's an anthropologist, I'm a biologist. And we found that when we would go to dinner with other anthropologists and biologists, we always talked about food and pleasure and taste. And there was this weird disconnect, you know, during the day we almost never did. We wrote this book, Delicious, as a sort of to start to think about, you know, what's the role that taste and flavor play in the species around us and our own lives? What's the biology of that? And it was a super fun endeavor. And so it sort of was then a template for part of this series and got us going.
I'll tell you what, I would love to be a fly on the wall in some of these big businesses such as Pepsi and Doritos, because these guys are trying to figure out what our flavor is right now, because they keep reinventing everything.
They do. And so they're relying on a really good understanding of elements of taste and flavor. And then they're also relying on a kind of trick. And the trick is that we can learn to like almost any smell, and flavor is taste plus mouthfeel plus other things plus smell. And so, you know, if you go to Subway, there's a Subway smell. Well, if your last experience at Subway was pleasant, every time you smell that smell, you have a pleasant sensation. Yeah. And so they're really engineering our response to the world around us in a dark but fascinating way.
Oh my God, when you talk like that though, when we go into these world markets that has fish from all over the world, oh, that smell, it's like, I got to get out of there quickly. But I never have a bad experience there, but you're always going to get that smell.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So I think there's a little bit of a disconnect between what neuroscientists know about some of those responses and our daily experience. And so I think we haven't reconciled those yet. And so neuroscientists would tell us that we can like any smell, and that aversion is learned. I think ecologists who study animals in the wild would tend to say, well, some of these smells seem innately repulsive. And so that stinky fish smell, I think maybe we have a tendency to inherently dislike it, and then we can learn to like it. Yeah. But for most people, the first reaction is negative. But the science is still out.
The experience of putting the book together and also doing the everything you've been doing with Curiosity Stream, I mean, that's two different personalities. How do you bring that all into one universe?
Yeah, that's actually a very good question. So they're just two different parts of my life. So the writing part is a quiet early morning part of thinking and a focus on words. And the curiosity part is really, you know, this is led by Ana Maria Talas, who really pulled this all together. She's just an amazing filmmaker and has a way of bringing to life what you can't do just with words. And so that's a very different skill set. It's way more of a team project. You know, it's following Ana Maria's lead. And what Ana Maria is so able to do is to lift up the voices of other people. And so if you look at the series, you'll see, oh, here are how chefs think about this. Here's how a neuroscientist thinks about this. Here's how a chemist thinks about this. And Ana Maria really can pull that together. And so the filmmaking piece is really this much more of a team element. And then there's obviously a performative element as well. I get to be a little bit more of the circus worker.
Yeah. See, I love that kind of thing when you break it down like that, because it's like music. You know, the drummer has a different experience compared to the lead guitarist, and now you add in the vocalist. Everybody has their own part in making this happen.
Yeah, for sure. I think the music is a great analogy. It is really like having you know, a team of musicians together, and Ana Maria is conducting. And if it works, like, you know, the drummer gets to play that piece, that part of the piece that they're really good at, and you know, you want to applaud after, and the, you know, you get to hear that perfect guitar riff right where it needs to be. So I think music is a perfect analogy.
Did we have to reteach our taste buds when it comes to gluten-free? Because, oh my God, it's something just seems to always be missing.
That's a great question, Arrow, and I'm not sure I know the answer on the fly. So I mean, one of our experiences of gluten is the mouth feel. It changes how the food feels in our mouth. Mm-hmm. And that is learned. And so, yeah, I think that's a reasonable hypothesis. I've never seen anyone who studied it. But certainly there are other things where we know we learn the mouthfeel, and you can learn to like one mouthfeel or another. There are other elements of mouthfeel that seem more universal, like crunchiness. It looks like everybody starts off just liking crunchy things, you know? So that potato chip that was fried twice and it's just nice and crunchy, that just seems like an inherent pleasure across people. Versus some other elements of mouthfeel seem like maybe they're a little more learned, but the gluten piece, that's a good question.
See, you just introduced me to something. This totally explains why I like Sour Patch Kids, because what it's doing inside my mouth, you know, that little, you know, whoa, what the heck was that? But you enjoy it.
Yeah. So Sour Patch Kids, these are great questions. So they're doing two things. One is there's like that like little explosion of something, right? Like it's not just sour. There's a feel. There's a kind of a ticklishness to the food. But the other part is that sour taste. And we've studied in my lab the evolution of sour taste. And it looks like that almost all mammals and birds dislike acidic foods. And sour is a measure of acidity. But relatively recently, our ancestors came to like it, especially when accompanied by sweet. And so there are multiple studies showing that, you know, if you put a lemon tree where a chimp population is, the chimps will learn to just go in the lemon tree and put lemons in their mouth until they're exhausted. And what we think is that this rewarded our ancestors for eating fermented things that were fermented with lactic acid bacteria or acetic acid bacteria.
Wow.
Like you would have in like yogurt or vinegar. Both make a food sour. And in both cases, that sourness kills pathogens. And so, you know, if our ancestors picked up a rotten fruit that was sour, it was safe. And so that sour was a reward. And so I think that Sour Patch Kids, when you enjoy them, you're tying into an ancient story, Arrow.
Dude, you got to come back to this show anytime in the future. I love breaking down flavor. I really do.
Oh, well, it's such a pleasure, Arrow. Thank you so much.
You be brilliant today, okay, sir?
Thank you. I appreciate that.